This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 27th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on this edition of Ozarks, our history doctor Bill Smith is back to explain that we don't know much about history, and we never really have, apparently. A new study that reveals America's lack of knowledge about our own country is nothing new. Something that is new, also later on the program, Governor Mike Beebe this week will address the Stonewall Democrats. It's the first time an Arkansas governor has formally addressed a gay civil rights organization. And the summer is marching on. We'll have a preview of the final concert in the KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival. First, Summer of Solutions. It's a 7-week-long grassroots volunteer-based program that wants to enable high school and college students to become effective community organizers and build solutions centered around a green economy. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker last week visited with program leaders Andrea Love and Serena Caffrey to find out more about the program.
So, the center, have you guys got, like, projects, or are we going to be, like, brainstorming it soon?
We have several projects in the works that we've been planning, but we also definitely have room for innovation and new initiatives and developing ones that we just have little, like, seedling ideas about.
11 youngsters sit in a semicircle in a house on South Combs Avenue in Fayetteville. They're all either high school or college students. They're also solutionaries, youth leaders who drive efforts in their communities to build solutions for opportunity, climate and energy crises, and social justice. These solutionaries are a part of the Summer of Solutions program, which, according to program leader Andrea Love, is a grassroots, volunteer-based program that empowers youngsters to benefit themselves by benefiting the community.
We're thinking about issues that we see in our communities and in our world, and challenging ourselves to come up with ways to address those solutions in ways that are sustainable and bring people together and grow community. We're building our team, we're building our skills, and we're also beginning to develop the ideas and the skills that will help us to work this summer. And it's really exciting. It's going really well.
Summer of Solutions was founded in the year 2008 in Twin Cities, Minnesota, by a group of college students. Since then, the program has spread to 15 cities across the nation, including Fayetteville. Andrea says while the focus was on food issues last year, this time the program hopes to expand its view and focus on the overall concept of a green economy.
The green economy is the vision that we see for the future. It's an economy built on energy from clean sources, jobs that are equitable and fair, and an economy that doesn't that's built on abundance and not scarce resources. An economy that's inclusive of people's needs and of all people. That kind of change involves a lot of small changes. And so we're not building a completely new economic system in Fayetteville this summer, but we are growing initiatives that think in this manner of prosperity and inclusiveness and sustainability, and thinking about long-term prosperity and long-term sustainability, and try to meet people's needs in very tangible ways.
The 2011 Summer of Solutions program began its training last week that will last until Wednesday. The participants then hope to work 40 hours a week interacting with local residents and organizing workshops and building solutions in partnership with various community-based organizations. Serena Caffrey, another Fayetteville program leader, says the model for this year's program is called the Listening Project.
We and our volunteers will be walking through the Walker Park neighborhood, having conversations with residents about what they think could improve in this community, and also cataloging what resources are available here, mapping the assets of this community so that we can involve residents in the solutions and in our projects. And so the next step from the Listening Project is called a challenge, a community challenge. And we'll be inviting residents to attend weekly or biweekly workshops in this neighborhood at community centers in coordination with partnerships. One of our partners is the Applied Sustainability Center's Ecological Communities Program. So we'll be working with energy efficiency in this neighborhood and helping residents track their energy use. We hope to work with some community art. We hope to collaborate with the Jefferson Garden, maybe increase bike access through workshops with Bike City or other bike co-ops in Fayetteville. And so a lot of this is still in its developmental stages.
We're also partnered with the Walker Park Community Garden, the Omni Center for Peace, Justice, and Ecology, and we're also going to be learning about agriculture and sustainable agriculture through farm visits to several local farms in the area.
Andrea and Serena were both participants in last year's Summer of Solutions program. Serena says, as program leaders this year, they've had to work harder to create an agenda for other participants, which in turn has helped them gain a better understanding of the objectives and the bigger picture.
As a program leader, both Andrea and I have access to a national support network within our organization. I didn't really know the extent or legacy of the work we were doing. And this year, through biweekly calls with other program leaders and support from mentors, for example, to put on this training week, we have so much more access to skills around the nation and thus can grow even more as mentors to the people in our program. And so something that I've learned from that process is that I would really love to engage our participants this year in the national network and involve them in that so they have ownership for it in the future and hopefully will continue with this work.
Conference calls that discuss issues being covered in program locations across the nation will help participants interact with other like-minded individuals. Regular postings on the Summer of Solutions blog will also help them keep in touch. Jonathan Wong is a solutionary at the Fayetteville Summer of Solutions chapter. Soon, he'll be moving to Berkeley, California to attend college and major in economics and statistics. He says Summer of Solutions enables and encourages students to solve problems and make a difference.
Here, I think, is a lot of kind of like a practical education. Like when you go through the public schooling system or high school or anywhere in the United States, it's kind of more theoretical. You get the information, but there aren't many opportunities to solve real problems. But here, you're given that opportunity. And you're not only given that opportunity here, but you're given like a great deal of freedom to kind of explore, kind of find out more about what you enjoy and kind of pursue those things as far as you want to. And I think that's great.
That ability and freedom to solve real-world problems is precisely what Andrea and Serena hope solutionaries will take away from this program.
The goal is for them to take away ways of thinking that are more complex, that recognize that there are a lot of problems in the world, and to not, we don't really glaze over that. We definitely recognize that the challenges that we're facing are some of the most difficult that human history has ever been given. But I think the key takeaway from this program is that we have the responsibility as this generation to start thinking of these problems. We think about them from the perspective of what can we do and how will we do it. And additionally, we hope that at the end of this summer, every participant feels comfortable and compelled to share these values and practices with others. We hope that they will have the knowledge to be able to train other people in this field so that this model is replicable and expandable and scalable on a nationwide and even international level.
Summer of Solutions is a 7-week program that helps youngsters build solutions and self-sustaining projects centered around communities. For more information, log on to www.grandaspirations.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mutholkar.
Earth, sky.
It's very difficult to predict where science and technology are going, even over a short time span. for the obvious reason that the greatest advances are often the least expected, and science follows them.
You're listening to renowned Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson, one of the world's best-known scientists and science communicators. He told Earth Sky he believes the 21st century will see profound advances in biology.
This is going to be a century of biology. Now we are entering an age of synthesis in which so many discoveries have been made in biology, in the cell, the molecular level, and on up to the development of organisms.
Dr. Wilson said he's hopeful that in this century, we'll see an end to hereditary diseases like cystic fibrosis.
I think we're on the edge, really, of mastering disease, particularly genetic disease. We will have genetic engineering in time that will allow the correcting of molecular structure to eliminate a genetic disease that does cripple such a large percentage of the human population today.
More at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Recently, there was a survey that detailed the lack of historical knowledge by high school students in the U.S. and by some political candidates. Our history doctor, Bill Smith, is here to help us sort out what these results mean. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be back. I have some shocking news for you. A survey of 7,000 high school students headed to some of the nation's most prestigious colleges and universities revealed that a high percentage of them did not know that Abraham Lincoln was the president during the Civil War period.
I actually did see that the news stories that resulted from that survey. There was some gnashing of teeth nationally. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor expressed regret about this, as did the president's Secretary of Education.
Indeed. There's only one problem, though. The survey that I'm speaking of is from April of 1943. This has become a standing problem in America that we periodically wring our hands and gnash our teeth, and the media proclaims the end of the world as we know it.
We hear about the lack of education that's in our public schools.
Absolutely. And there will always be in this, along with the condemnation of the public schools, will be the requisite member or former member of the government, in this case, Sandra Day O'Connor, the very well-respected jurist and former Supreme Court member, upset that we are going to lose our democracy. Our founding fathers would be aghast at the lack of knowledge of the past, the lack of civics, the lack of background, and how this will make us such a terrible nation and unable to go forward and an idiotic electorate. Unfortunately, this is a mainstay of American history.
I don't know if that's what we want to plant our flag into. However,
the reality is thus. And you know, the reason I bring up 1943, and it has been dug up by a lot of other people in reaction to this national assessment that's come out of the Obama Department of Education, because the New York Times created this survey in response to what was going on. In 1943, we were a little busy with this thing called the Second World War, and to sort of test the patriotism of the youth of America. And the youth of America were found wanting when it came to their historical knowledge. There are actually journal articles and studies that mark the decades as they go past, dating back to this 1943. By the way, this was a front-page story in the Times, and it ran for a week of counter back and forth of people worried and saying it wasn't a big deal.
In 43.
In 1943. Okay. So this is big news in 1943.
Right.
Just as this recent survey is big news now in all the chattering class and on the cable news channels. So 1976, bicentennial year, we have, oh my gosh, these kids don't know anything.
That's when you and I were kids.
That's right. 1987, another report. This one done also by the Department of Education. These kids don't know anything. 2002. Department of Education, again, a national assessment of, and regrettably, it's pretty consistent. We're just not a nation that's very knowledgeable of its history.
Of course, there was a big to-do this spring when there was a certain perhaps presidential candidate who was asked while in Boston about some history or what she enjoyed about the city. I'm talking, of course, about Sarah Palin. And she made comments about Paul Revere.
Indeed. And not only that Republican potential, maybe, who knows if she's a candidate, but a declared candidate in Michelle Bachmann.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Confusing her Concords.
Yes, yes.
So basically you have a pair of nominees of a major party that are very confused at some level about their colonial history. Now, you know, making a critical error on the stump. Bachmann's in particular reminded me more of the classic rock and roll concert mistake of confusing what town you were in.
Hello, Cleveland.
Exactly.
Yes.
And she just was standing in the wrong state when she was talking about how fantastic Concord, not New Hampshire, rather Massachusetts was. So you have Palin's more famously reported comment that Paul Revere wrote out to warn the British. And more importantly, Palin not wanting to admit to maybe being confused and steering way into the skid and saying, well, he actually was warning the British. Now, what I was waiting for her to more to go with was something, you know, everybody was a British subject, you betcha kind of angle. But she didn't go for that. She claimed that because he did get stopped later and did tell British troops that was him warning the British. And they're like, okay, you're going a little too far in on scholarship to try to make your point true.
Let me just, as a side note, say, here's what I suspect sometimes, is that when someone who you like makes a very public gaffe, you remember President Obama, when he was candidate, Obama said something about the
57 states.
Right.
Yes.
If you like, if he's your guy, if you like him, you say, you know what? He's been campaigning a long time. It's no big deal. We know he knows there's 50 states. But if you don't like the candidate, if it's Sarah Palin doing this, then you go for the jugular. I think it's just part of politics.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head when it comes to the partisan nature of politics. And I think we have to recognize in this modern era the partisan nature of media.
Mm-hmm.
And that you will have certain media that are going to emphasize that mistake over others. And the reality was probably right there in the middle, as we said about Bachmann. You just lost your place and something spilled out of your mouth. That never happens here, by the way. That... just
right, right. You know, it. When someone says the wrong number of states or the wrong place, this isn't policy we're talking about. And anyone can make a mistake. That's all I'm going to say.
Exactly.
Okay, I got you off line. So it's no surprise that you could have candidates or office holders who, in the course of their career, will get something wrong. But now, what about these surveys? What do these surveys tell us?
Well,
I mean, these consistent...
The very same National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP. Mm-hmm. I mean, this in the last several presidential administrations has been the same object, the same survey. Now, when you talk about the New York Times survey back in 43, obviously different instrument, different questions. But, I mean, here's what it's finding out. In the late 80s, 32% of high school students could not place the Civil War in the right part of the 19th century. 42% got Joseph McCarthy not being a part of the Red Scare. And 57% could not place World War I as happening in the first half of the 20th century.
Now, I don't care when that survey's taken. That gives you pause.
Well, it does.
Yes.
It does. My favorite thing in going back and looking at this is a journal article in the history journals in 1993 that is bemoaning the 50-year-long angst that's happened ever since that first 1943 event. The survey in 2001 by the Department of Education, and I bring up the different ones to say this isn't an Obama administration, a Bush administration, a Clinton administration. You'll hear the years we've used, a Bush 1 administration. It's spread out across time. The 2001 version found that few 12th graders knew that the Gulf of Tonkin incident led to the escalation of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. They confused Thomas Jefferson with Jefferson Davis.
That one hurts.
But this just means that Generation X shares something with the greatest generation after all, which, by the way, the greatest generation in 43 found that there were significant numbers that thought that we bought Alaska from the Dutch and Hawaii from Norway.
Okay, Alaska from the Dutch... Hawaii from Norway? Why? I don't even see the reasoning for that. Anyway, this is not just, or is this just a historical problem? I don't mean to have a pun there.
Well, in some ways, yes. And in some ways, I would tell you it's a bit of an invention of the media itself. Remember, the genesis for this is a 1943 story commissioned off of a survey for the New York Times. It was, in its own way, a little yellow journalism there. They're going to shock America during a time in which we're trying to build up our patriotism and convince everyone they need to be more American. Mm-hmm. And what better way to be more American than to learn your American history?
This brings you to an interesting point, because you're saying, here we go again, wringing our hands about this. But you, being a historian and such a lover of history, it still has to bother you that more people don't know more about history.
It does. And I think some of that comes back to the fact that a lot of people just don't value history. And I say this in a little H, history. Neil Postman has a very famous quote about this, and I'm fond of using it in the classroom and in presentations, that he basically says that history is a meta subject. Everything has a history. When people tell you they're bored with history, one of the things that I'll always say to them is, oh, wait a minute, now what's your job? Oh, I'm in banking. I'm a lawyer. I'm a doctor. Really? Well, now, the history of medicine, that was important to you when you were in med school, right? You have to know these details. You have to know the past background to be able to operate in the field. Oh, yes, of course, that's very important. I have to know that. Well, that's history.
Any final thoughts about this?
Well, you know, I think President Harry Truman said this best, and it's on the masthead of our We're History blog page. The only thing new in history is the history we don't know.
And until we buy an island from Norway,
we're history.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
Bill Smith earned his Ph.D. in history at the University of Arkansas and serves on the board of the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. Support for Ozarks at Large is provided by the Rogers Historical Museum and What's Cooking, Two Centuries of American Foodways. This exhibit explores years of cooking through photographs, utensils and appliances, tableware, and a hands-on activity featuring cooking gadgets of the past. Open through August 20th, 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information. And the KUAF 13th Annual Summer Jazz Series will begin July 16th with jazz pianist Eldar Janjerov. The series will continue with the Composer Showcase on August 4th and then vibraphonist Warren Wolf on August 26th. All performances begin at 8 p.m. in Walton Arts Center Star Theater. Tickets, including limited cabaret seating, are on sale. For tickets, 443-5600 or waltonartcenter.org. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 27th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. The Arkansas Department of Correction says it expects to save nearly $750,000 a year thanks to conservation efforts being implemented at many of the state's prisons. Shay Wilson is a spokesperson for the department.
ADC began looking at ways that we could save money and save on energy and that type of thing. So we, our conservation efforts began with retrofitting and upgrading lighting and upgrading heating and air conditioning systems at four of our oldest units, Cummins, Tucker, Barner, and Wrightsville.
Ms. Wilson says improvements were also made to air conditioning and heating units at the oldest prisons in Arkansas. The efforts to find ways to save energy and money were mandated by a law passed by state lawmakers in 2009. The Arkansas Department of Health, along with several other health groups, is sponsoring the National HIV Testing Day in Arkansas today. To further support the testing day, the Department of Health is hosting free HIV clinics during the entire week across most of the state. Ed Barham with the Department of Health says it's important for everyone to know their HIV status.
It's a quick test, and it's certainly painless. So you can find out in short order and know your status. And that should provide you with peace of mind.
Ed Barham says the test is only a mouth swab and people will be able to see the results later the same day.
For the last many years now, we've seen rising rates of HIV. Today we have just over 3,000 people living with HIV/AIDS in Arkansas.
Barham says HIV is a much more treatable disease now than in the past 10 years. Members of the University of Arkansas men's track and field team are moving on to the World Championships this summer after winning events at their national championships this weekend. Tariq Batchelor won the long jump at the Jamaican National Championships in Kingston, and Raymond Higgs won the long jump competition at the national championships in the Bahamas this weekend. Meanwhile, Grace Hamesfield finished second in the junior 3,000-meter steeplechase Saturday at the 2011 USA Outdoor Track and Field Championships in Eugene, Oregon. The soon-to-be Razorback sophomore for the women's track and field team has now earned the chance to run for Team USA at the 2011 Pan American Junior Championships. She is a native of Elkins. This is Ozarks at Large. It's Monday, June 27th, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Let's go somewhere.
All right. It's summer. That's kind of what
it's
you do in summer.
Let's go somewhere.
Where do you want to go?
Let's go to Little Rock for a concert that's being called for lovers only. It's July 9th. It happens at Robinson Center Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And it includes performances by American Idol star Fantasia and Grammy nominee Tank, among others.
Okay.
It's 8 o'clock. Tickets are $52 to $62 at Ticketmaster.com. Also in the surrounding area, I believe you were real excited about this a week or so ago, June 30th, which is the
Thursday.
End of this week, Thursday, Elvis Costello plays at Crossroads KC.
Yes.
July 12th, Steely Dan at the Brady Theater in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
July 12th, Britney Spears at the American Airlines Center in Dallas. She's still touring. Okay, July 13th, Crosby and Nash.
No Stills, no Young.
But two out of four is not bad.
That's right.
Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That'll be a good show at Kane's.
July 17th, New Kids on the Block.
Can they really use that first word? Are they really still the New Kids on the Block?
Well, they are at the BOK
Center. How about
Center
been around
in Tulsa?
The block?
That's July 17th. And also July 17th, what can you say about him? Ted Nugent at the New Daisy Theater in Memphis. You can check out more events away in What's Up, and we'll keep picking out some interesting Summer Roads trips for you.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
150 years ago, a Confederate army began to form in Arkansas. While some volunteer companies were immediately sent to serve east of the Mississippi River, others gathered in North Arkansas for their military training. In the eastern part of the state, Thomas H. Bradley established camps along the current river at Pittman's Ferry, Perkins Ferry, and Pocahontas. West Point graduate N. Bart Pierce commanded the western troops, training them at camps in Benton and Washington counties. In June, Brigadier General Ben McCulloch marched north to join Pierce with regiments of soldiers from Texas and Louisiana. 2 months later, these men would see the first pitched battle in the Trans-Mississippi when they faced an aggressive Union army and bloody fighting at Wilson's Creek, Missouri. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
Tomorrow night, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe will speak at a meeting of the Arkansas Stonewall Democrats at First Presbyterian Church in Little Rock. The Stonewall Democrats, who invited the governor, are an official caucus of the state Democratic Party dedicated to electing LGBTQ candidates and pro-equality candidates. The governor's visit marks the first time an Arkansas governor will formally address a gay civil rights organization. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
The Stonewall Democrats, based in Washington, D.C., is a political voice for LGBTQ Americans. LGBTQ is an acronym for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, and questioning. Stonewall Democrat auxiliaries have been sanctioned in 33 states, including Texas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas. State President Eric McDaniel spoke from Axiom, where he works as an analyst in Little Rock.
Stonewall Democrats of Arkansas is actually an official caucus of the Democratic Party of Arkansas, and we're very proud of that, being a southern state. It's been a caucus for about 10 years now, I believe.
McDaniel says Arkansas Stonewall Democrats have not encountered any bias within their state party.
As president of the Stonewall Democratic Caucus, I'm on the state committee and the executive committee of the Democratic Party of Arkansas, and I attend those meetings regularly and am very welcome. I've never felt unwelcome at all.
Stonewall Democrats count around 340 active supporters in Arkansas. The name Stonewall traces back to one of the nation's first gay civil rights protests in 1969. At a New York inn by that name in Greenwich Village, gay patrons who had been routinely hassled by law authorities fought back. Today, thousands of national and local LGBTQ rights groups across the country are working on all kinds of issues.
Certainly, Stonewall Democrats at its core is for equal rights of all Arkansans. But we do focus on the equal rights concerns that we have for those that are LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender.
Although gay marriage is outlawed in the United States under the Defense of Marriage Act, a half dozen states allow it. And last year, President Obama ordered the Justice Department to stop defending the constitutionality of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which Eric McDaniel says is a start.
Our reaction was very favorable, obviously. We support his decision not to defend any longer. Our position is that we're not asking for special rights. We're just asking for equal rights.
Ending job discrimination is another political plank.
We'd certainly like to see changes in Arkansas in regards to employment rights. In Arkansas currently, if your employer could relieve you simply because you're gay or lesbian or bisexual, transgender, that's in our opinion, it's just unfair and not right.
Last December, President Barack Obama also signed into law a bill creating a path to end the practice known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which bars gays from coming out in the military. If they do go public, they are discharged. Right now, certain members of Congress are working to block repeal.
We have the President of the United States and the leadership of the military saying move forward with repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So any efforts to prevent people from serving their country proudly based upon their sexual orientation or gender identity, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It's nothing but harmful to me, in my opinion.
Here in Arkansas, a 15-year-long battle ended early April. The Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a law banning unmarried couples in sexual relationship, both gay and straight, from serving as adoptive or foster parents. The American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of Arkansas filed a lawsuit against the ban on behalf of children, parents, and couples harmed by the law, known as Act 1, in December 2008. The state Supreme Court decision affirmed an earlier ruling by the Pulaski County Circuit Court holding that Act 1, a state ballot initiative sponsored by the Conservative Family Council in Little Rock, violates the Arkansas Constitution's guarantee of a right to privacy.
We were very pleased, very, very pleased to know that the Supreme Court of Arkansas struck down Act 1. There are so many children that need to go to loving homes. And without question, in my mind, some of the most loving homes that I've been in are those of gay and lesbians.
The state's first domestic partnership registry operates in Eureka Springs. Domestic partners sign an affidavit stating they've lived together for a certain amount of time, are exclusive, and share all property and financial resources. Domestic partners include both same-sex couples and unmarried opposite-sex couples. Benefits offered to domestic partners can include long-term care insurance, group life insurance, bereavement, sick leave, and relocation benefits, as well as health, dental, and vision insurance. Because gay marriage in most states is illegal, this is a path toward securing benefits provided by many Fortune 500 companies.
Domestic partner benefits is another one. I'm proud to say that as an employee of Axiom Corporation, they do extend partner benefits to domestic partnerships that you just simply need to prove that you do have a domestic partner living with you and a committed relationship. So I'm very proud of Axiom, and hope that other corporations will move forward and that the state will help that be possible.
Eric McDaniel pointed to the work of the state legislature and Arkansas Governor Beebe, who passed a law requiring anti-bullying policies in every school, including protection for sexual orientation and gender identity.
I was very pleased that the anti-bullying legislation was signed into law this year. I saw the governor sign it. I was very proud of that moment, particularly because it includes language protecting folks due to sexual orientation or gender identity. Having the gender identity and sexual orientation included in that language was just a major plus and something we're very proud of.
And on Tuesday, Governor Beebe will address a quarterly meeting of the Arkansas Stonewall Democrats by special invitation.
We extend the invitation to both the governor and the new chairman of the Democratic Party of Arkansas, Will Bonds. Both have accepted, and so since they both did, we wanted to get on the governor's calendar as quickly as possible for the next coming meeting. So it's really just our quarterly meeting, and he's going to be the keynote speaker.
The governor has agreed to field questions, which Eric McDaniel will facilitate.
We believe he's done a really good job in many respects for the state, and so he's a respectable governor. And we look forward to having him. He's done a lot for the state in regards to education. We have a balanced budget. I feel like he's got a good handle on the state in regards to taxes. And we've expanded, under his leadership, we've expanded Our Kids First. So we believe he's a very effective governor and very proud to have him come speak to us.
Governor Mike Beebe's appearance will coincide with Pride. For the third year in a row, President Barack Obama issued a proclamation recognizing June as Pride Month for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered Americans. Every year, across the country, Pride is celebrated by Americans with rallies, parades, and parties. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Stephen Gates, who is the organizer and curator of the KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival. And Stephen, we've come...
Here we are talking about the last concert of the summer.
It's hard to believe.
It is. Although a lot of work for all of us who do this, it at the same time goes fast.
It's harder, I guess, for me to believe who hasn't put the festival together. Cilla Boyle-Smith will be the site for the sixth and final concert.
Yep. And by now, most of the people who are playing on this program are well known to our audience. We're playing a program that, in particular, I'm going to go a little bit backwards here, features, we're closing with a Brahms piano quartet, which means piano, violin, viola, and cello. And we've done this somewhat by chance rather than design. The first two summers, we also closed the festival with a Brahms piano quartet. And he wrote a total of three.
Uh-oh.
So this is it for that. And so maybe next summer either we'll start over or have to do something differently. But as are the other two that we've done, it's just a wonderful piece. Very exciting and beautiful and just what you'd expect from Brahms chamber music.
You say it's more by chance than design. You knew you wanted to do this Brahms piece?
And I knew the first summer in particular, I really wanted to do the one we did at the end of the first summer. And then last summer we thought, well, hey, let's do one of the other two. And we chose the one we did last summer, and this is the only one left, and they're all... terrific. I mean, the first one, the main reason I wanted to do it was I had not played it before. This, the one last summer I had played, and this one I've played some of. I don't think I ever have performed this, though.
Oh, okay.
So it should be fun.
You'll end with Brahms. You'll begin with Mozart.
Begin with Mozart. Good chamber music buddies, you know, mm-hmm. Mozart and Brahms. In this case, it's a Mozart string quartet, two violins, viola, cello. And actually, it's the second Mozart string quartet we've done this summer. And again, not so much by design, but by the way we were able to get people to come and participate in the festival. And we knew we had the people here, and it's a piece that Ergene and I had wanted to do even earlier in the year, but hadn't gotten to it. And so we're going to start the program with that. And we have a guest violinist who will be back for the second week to play the first violin part. And Ergene is playing second. And Jesse Collette, whom I meant to talk about a little bit last week when we spoke, is playing viola. And he had a late school year. He teaches public schools up in Rogers or Bentonville,
I believe.
Bentonville,
yeah.
Thank you. And so his late school year made it difficult for him to participate too soon, but he's finishing up the festival with us, and it's nice to have him back too.
You a grad, Jesse?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, both undergraduate and graduate degrees from us. Yeah, and a very good violist and a, you know, a nice guy to work with. And that, you know, when you have to rehearse so much in a relatively short amount of time, it's really important to have people who get along, let's say, compatible.
So for Mozart, two violins, viola, and cello, it's the same instrument lineup for the Stravinsky. That'll be second.
That's
on the program.
Right. And the Stravinsky is just a little piece that I have known about but never played. And actually, it was Ergene's suggestion that we do this piece. It's three, as its title is, three pieces. They're really very short pieces, very much like, if they had been in the 19th century, we would have called them sort of character pieces. They're sort of folk-inspired, and they do some sort of funky things with rhythm that one might expect of Stravinsky, but at the same time, for people who cringe at the name Stravinsky, this isn't that way at all. they're you know, they're sort of fascinating pieces, and as I have said about some other compositions, they don't wear out their welcome. They're short, they get to the point, and you know, just as you're sort of saying, well, okay, I see what he's up to here, it's time to end and go on to the next one. So I think the three of them might take 10 minutes or less put together. So
When a non-musician hears a cellist say, oh, I was familiar or had heard of this Stravinsky piece, but had never played it,
right,
I think we kind of scratch our heads and go, "How can you? What do you mean when you were familiar or had heard of a Stravinsky piece?"
Well, I have owned, I'm showing my age here, an LP of these pieces along with some other things that I bought, I believe, when I was back in college. And so I had this recording that I had not listened to much. And I remember, because Stravinsky, one of the kind of interesting things about him is that he didn't write in a lot of really traditional, for a lot of traditional musical groups, for in traditional genres. And so the string quartet was really popular in a way amongst early 20th century composers, Bartok and Schoenberg notably. And I was thinking to myself way back, well, didn't Stravinsky write anything for string quartet? And that's how I sort of came upon this. And this is not what anyone, including Stravinsky, I'm sure, would consider a major work. It almost sounds as if he was just thinking one day, or maybe he had been to a string quartet concert and he thought, you know, it might be fun to write for that group. So he just sort of, it feels like he just, although carefully notated as it always is with Stravinsky, just sort of jotted down some ideas.
So it's kind of, Faulkner, of course, wrote novels, but he also wrote short stories. So this is kind of a Stravinsky short story.
Kind of. I think that's a good analogy. I think that's very true here.
Mozart, Stravinsky, and then
the Brahms
to end the summer.
Yep.
And when do you start thinking about 2012?
Well, certainly by our winter break. I mean, certainly by January, we start talking about what we'd like to do and whom we'd like to invite. And we start talking to people, in particular, you know, local people, what their summer schedules are going to be like. You know, are they, have we had already 10 snow days and things, things like that, that are, and we find out when the Walmart meeting is so we can move to an off-campus site for that concert. And so start trying to make sure we have our venues pinned down. And then the real fun part, of course, is planning the programs and getting people together and saying, you know, wouldn't you like to do this? And gee, wouldn't this be fun kind of thing.
So July will begin the day after. Academic year for you doesn't start for 6 or 7 weeks. What's the relationship you have with your cello during this sort of summer break for you? Will you be with it every day?
I probably won't, honestly. I will practice some, especially as we get near the beginning of school, because I'm hoping to do some more chamber music concerts once we get into the school year. But I think I have a lot of yard work lined up for myself. And so I may do some yard work for a bit and then try to get my fingers moving again on the cello.
Well, best of luck with everything that the summer holds. It's at Syllable Smith. It's Thursday night at 7:30. It is
June 30th.
There is cake at the end.
There is. And it'll be fun.
Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you so much, as ever.
And we'll talk to you during the fall.
I hope so.
Okay.
That'll be a pleasure.
Monday, June 27th edition of Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor is ahead. An Asian cultural extravaganza is scheduled to take place tonight, beginning at 6:30 at the Rogers Public Library. There will be demonstrations of many Asian cultural arts tonight. Presenters will model fashion, dancing, music, magic, books, jewelry, and calligraphy, plus cuisine from Chinese, Hmong, Indian, Laotian, Marshallese, Thai, and Vietnamese cooks. For more information, you can call 621-1152. Again, it begins at 6:30 at the Rogers Public Library. It's open to the public, and all ages are invited. And Ozarks at Large is on Facebook. If you become our friend on Facebook, you'll get previews about what stories we're working on, links to extras that we couldn't fit onto the air, and more. It's all available at the Ozarks at Large Facebook page.
Well, funny is as funny does. John's in Kansas City. John?
Yes.
What have you gotten for Father's Day that you never use and you hope you'll never see again?
Well, this year my wife got me a bigger life insurance policy.
She's so thoughtful that way. Chuckle along with me this week on Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? From PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know? With Michael Feldman. Saturday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 27th of June, 2011. It was on this day, 1844, Joseph Smith, Jr., 39 years old, founder of the Latter-day Saints movement, was killed by a mob in Carthage, Illinois. He'd come from back east, where, at the age of 18, he said he'd been visited by the angel Moroni, who directed him to some gold plates on which were written the history of the Israelites, which he then translated and so wrote the Book of Mormon, on which he based a new Christian sect. He and his followers moved west in 1831. They were headed to Missouri. They passed through the town of Kirtland, Ohio, where they made a great many converts, about 100 of them, which about doubled the size of their church. They stayed in Kirtland for 8 years before they were expelled from there. They headed for Missouri, but stopped in Illinois, in the town of Commerce, which they renamed Nauvoo. Public opinion turned against them there. Joseph Smith petitioned Congress to name Nauvoo an independent territory, and he also announced himself as a candidate for president. He got into trouble with a newspaper which had accused him of practicing polygamy, and when he ordered the destruction of the newspaper building, he was arrested and jailed in Carthage, Illinois, where 200 men, their faces painted black, broke into the jail and shot Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram to death. It's the birthday of Helen Keller, born in Tuscumbia, Alabama, 1880. As a small child, she came down with scarlet fever, which left her blind and deaf. She learned to read and write. She was admitted to Radcliffe, published a book, The Story of My Life, starred in a movie, went on vaudeville tours, and became a great celebrity, an inspirational figure who struggled with her handicaps. Helen Keller was much more political than we remember her as. She was a socialist. She supported Eugene Debs running for president. She was a member of the International Workers of the World, and she was opposed to World War I. It's the birthday of the poet Frank O'Hara, born in Baltimore in 1926, and the poet Lucille Clifton, born in Depew, New York, 1936. And it was on this day in 1950 the United States entered the Korean War, a war that lasted 3 years, cost over 2.5 million lives, the forgotten war that came between World War II and the war in Vietnam. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bernard Haas, Siren. Here is the poem I meant to write, but didn't, because you walked into my study without any clothes on. I had just been thinking of how the Aegean sun must have lit up the faces of Troy's fallen heroes when you walked into my study without any clothes on, walked in and stood there, holding a glass of sherry over your left breast, which looked soft and firm as brie. Your tone of voice this morning should have warned me that you might walk into my study without any clothes on. I should have lashed myself to my chair and stoppered my ears with wax, but I forgot, and I'm glad I forgot. Because when you walked into my study without any clothes on, you sang sweetly, and I died nobly like a man. Siren by Robert Bernard Haas from his collection Counting Thunder, published by David Robert Books and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Almost out of time for this edition of Ozarks at Large. A couple of museum notes for the 4th of July weekend to keep in mind. Independent researcher Robert Myers will present his program Undercover of Darkness, Buried Treasure, Magic, and Deception in the Ozark Mountains. It's a program on treasure hunter Charlie Gonzalez. It will take place Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. That's at the corner of Johnson and Main in downtown Springdale. If you'd like more information about Saturday's program, 750-8165. And the Fort Smith Museum of History will present a patriotic craft-making event for children on Monday, the 4th, from 2 until 4 at the museum. Refreshments are included. This event is free. It's open to children 12 years and younger. Children must be accompanied by a parent. Reservations are required as well. You can call 783-7841. The Fort Smith Museum of History is at 320 Rogers Avenue in downtown Fort Smith. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville. MENA, your NPR affiliate for the past 26 years, and your source for community events. Remember, you can enter your own community event information at our website, KUAF.com. If you'd like to hear any portion of this show again or share it with friends via Facebook, Twitter, or any of those other social media outlets, you can do that at OzarksAtLarge.com. There we also have information about the music you hear in each program and links that will help you find out more about the stories. That's all available at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'll be back tomorrow at noon along with Antoinette Grajeda for another new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great Monday.